Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation and the California Healthcare Foundation, supporting ideas and innovations to improve healthcare for all Californians. On the web at chcf.org.
From Valley Public Radio in Fresno and Bakersfield, this is Valley Edition, FM 89's weekly news magazine program. I'm Joe Moore. On today's show, what will a changing climate mean for residents of the Central Valley and for our health? We'll talk with author Linda Marsa about her new book, Fevered, and hear not just about the problems, but also some solutions. We'll also talk with Fresno Unified Superintendent Michael Hansen and find out what the Obama administration's decision to give the district a waiver from the No Child Left Behind Act will mean for district students. And later in the show, we'll talk with Kerman farmer Paul Betancourt about the challenges of balancing the environment and agriculture. It's the subject of his new book called 10 Reasons. That and how UC scientists are working to bring back abalone populations, that's all coming up on Valley Edition. But first, the news.
With these news headlines, I'm Ezra Romero. A judge has ruled on a community group's lawsuit against the city of Fresno and the controversial Darlene rendering plant in West Fresno. FM 89's Rebecca Plevin reports.
A lawsuit against the operators of a controversial rendering plant in southwest Fresno can move forward, according to an order issued Monday by Superior Court Judge Mark Snoffer. The judge ruled that a community group, Concerned Citizens of West Fresno, could seek an injunction to prevent Darling International, Inc. from operating the rendering plant without a conditional use permit, based on their claims that it's a public nuisance. Phoebe Seaton is a lawyer for the community group.
This ruling allows Concerned Citizens of West Fresno to proceed with their case against Darling for Darling's failure to comply with the Fresno Municipal Code.
But the judge also dismissed several of the group's arguments. Snoffer ruled that the city is not required to enforce its code and zoning laws. Seaton says her clients are disappointed with the judge's decision.
I spoke with one client today, Mrs. Mary Curry, and she's disappointed that as a taxpayer, she and her neighbors and other residents of Fresno don't have the authority to require this city to enforce its own codes, which she feels the city is not enforcing fairly.
The plant has been a concern for area residents for decades. When the plant opened in the 1940s, the facility was under the jurisdiction of the County of Fresno. In 1972, it was annexed by the City of Fresno, but never obtained the permits the city typically requires for such facilities. Concerned Citizens of West Fresno is considering appealing the order. With Valley Public Radio, I'm Rebecca Plevin.
A bill that would increase fines for big air polluters in California is now headed to the Assembly floor. As Amy Quinton reports from Sacramento, it was drafted in response to the Chevron oil refinery fire in Richmond last year.
The Chevron oil refinery fire forced 15,000 people to seek medical help. Under current law, such a violation would result in a $10,000 fine. Democratic Senator Lonnie Hancock says the legislation she's authored would increase the fine to $100,000.
The incidents like this that dramatically impact entire communities have no higher penalty ceilings than incidents that affect only a very few people.
But Mira Girton with the California Chamber of Commerce says the bill is far too broad.
There's nothing in the bill that actually limits this to events that affect large numbers of people, and more importantly, to large amounts of a chemical being released. And that has been the subject of negotiations for the last 5 months, all through the Senate and all through the summer, and the language is still not in the bill.
The bill is on the chamber's job killer list. It passed on a party line vote. In Sacramento, I'm Amy Quinton.
The California Supreme Court has ruled that employees without medical licenses can give insulin shots to diabetic students in some cases. Monday's unanimous ruling reverses a lower court decision that permitted only licensed nurses to give the shot. Dr. Francis Prieto is with the American Diabetes Association. He says the ruling is necessary to keep students at understaffed schools safe.
Most schools do not have a full-time nurse present all day long, and kids with diabetes need care.
The American Nurses Association filed the original case. It says the high court ruling could endanger diabetic students by allowing non-professionals to give injections. Maureen Cones is with the association.
Insulin can be lethal if it is administered improperly. So we do see a risk to students.
The American Nurses Association is considering an appeal to the U.S. Supreme Court. For Valley Public Radio News, I'm Ezra Romero.
This is Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio. Last week, the U.S. Department of Education granted 8 of California's largest school districts a waiver from certain provisions of the No Child Left Behind Act. The districts, which include Sanger Unified and Fresno Unified, are all members of a coalition called the California Office to Reform Education, or CORE. The group sought the waiver for their individual districts after a similar request by the state of California was rejected last year over a dispute about tying test scores to teacher evaluations. Nationwide, 39 states and the District of Columbia have also received waivers from the law, but this is the first time individual districts have received such a designation. Joining us now to talk about what this new waiver means for students and educators is Fresno Unified Superintendent Michael Hansen. Welcome.
Happy to be here.
You've called this waiver earth-shattering. That's a pretty dramatic statement. Why is this so important for your district?
Well, I think it's important for all 8 districts, first off, because it represents a million kids in California, and it allows us to do work very differently. First and foremost, what we've done is we have taken an accountability system that said at both the state and federal level that if you did not have 100 kids in an identified subgroup, they, in essence, didn't count, they weren't measured, they weren't visible, and did not show up. So if you had a school of 1,000 middle school kids, and you only had 88 African-American kids and 65 English learners on that campus, when your reports came back, those students did not show up, regardless of how they performed. And by definition, then, staff, because they weren't held to it, would not necessarily take time and energy to try to figure out what they would be doing next. That was more than ironic when we were living under something called No Child Left Behind, when we were, in fact, leaving thousands of kids behind. So our model, what we did is we proposed moving to one where the N size, to be accountable, moved from 100 on a campus all the way down to 20. So now if students with disabilities or English learners or socioeconomically disadvantaged or African-American or Latino students, you pick the subgroup, if there is 21 students on that campus, they will now show up, and that has dramatic results. So just across our consortium of a million kids, there will be another 185,000 students or so that will show up, and our campuses, our districts, and our communities will have to start dealing with how we move all those kids forward, and we think that's just a dramatic move in the world of equity. To give you a sense of what it does for Fresno alone, this will mean, under these new rules, 55 Fresno Unified Schools will now have reported an Asian subgroup that last year, with the same populations being reported, did not have an Asian subgroup. Because they had between 21 and 99 kids on that campus, they didn't count before. Mind you, the state of California nor the feds in Washington, D.C. asked us to do this. This was something we were compelled to do because we think it's good for families, students, schools, communities, and ultimately our state. And so that's just one dramatic way that we think we're pushing the envelope to do more for more students in this new world.
One of the biggest criticisms of No Child Left Behind has been the emphasis on standardized testing and rating school performance. With this new waiver system, how is that changing with this new analysis method, the school quality improvement system?
That's a great question. So under No Child Left Behind, in grades 2 through 8, 3 through 8, and the high school exit exam, we would take a test at the end of the year for our students in mathematics and English language arts. Those test scores would drive the definition of your school. You're either good, you're in program improvement, you need to be chartered or blown up and start all over, or not. And that's simply, people who would complain about that, I would be one of those people, have legitimate beefs. A single test score does not define a student or a classroom teacher's performance or a school's performance. So what we did is we proposed something quite different. 100% of what defines a school, we broke down this way. 60% of it would be on academic measures. And another 20% of it would be on social-emotional measures. And then another 20% of it would be on campus culture and climate issues. So in the first big bucket of 60%, there would be academic tests that would be part of the score that would help to generate what your school looks like. We would also take into account graduation rates and persistence rates in grades 8 through 11, for example. That makes up 60% of the score. Another 20% of the score would start to talk about social-emotional issues like chronic attendance issues, suspension rates, expulsion rates. How are students actually doing? How are they connected to school? Are they coming? And what does the environment look like for them? And then the third bucket is all about feedback from stakeholders, our parents, our teachers, our students. We would be doing surveys and bringing all of that data together to give us a composite number that we think much more thoroughly and holistically reflects what actually is going on, not just in classrooms, but on that entire campus and in that local community. We think it's fairer, we think it's more descriptive, and we think it's something that is much more engaging for our families, our students, and our professionals working on behalf of students every day.
How does this change your plans in implementing the new state curriculum, Common Core, that's being implemented across the state? Does this change it in any way?
Actually, it is. Everything that we are doing in this group of core is all about making sure we are doing our absolute level best to implement the Common Core state standard. So one of the fundamental conditions for us to earn this waiver from Secretary Duncan and the Obama administration was that we had to sign on to the fact that we would be fully implementing Common Core state standards in the year 13-14. So, and that also, mind you, is a requirement from Governor Brown in the new local control funding formula. We know the Common Core state standards are good. They're rigorous. We've advocated for them. We think they're good for children and youth. And our funding formula in the state that's now changed after 40 years calls for it. Our governor actually put resources behind helping our teachers and leaders learn how to do it more thoroughly, more quickly. And now we have a federal accountability system that is pushing us to do the same thing, and it's actually measuring a broader set of indicators that we think are all healthy.
You have 8 of the largest school districts in the state as members of this group. What role will CORE have, this coalition have, moving forward? And I've heard talk about districts holding districts accountable and different councils and things that are going to come together in terms of implementing this over the next year. What role does the group have in the next year?
Well, so just two things. So we have the districts, there are 10 districts in CORE. Clovis and Garden Grove are two other ones that did not sign on to the waiver at this point. But the districts that did sign on are San Francisco, Oakland, Sacramento, Fresno, Sanger, Los Angeles, Santa Ana, and Long Beach. And I say Sanger because people wonder sometimes what are they doing there with big urbans. Sanger is a phenomenal district. Their board, their teachers, their staff, Mark Johnson, and now to Matt Novo, a phenomenal new superintendent there, and his staff. They have much to teach the rural districts across our state about how we can best do this work together. And what we're going to be doing in the accountability world is networking our districts together. And instead of saying under the old rules, you didn't hit an artificial barrier on a single test score, therefore you're bad, and we're going to take some immediate sanctions on you, we are now going to be able to say we have a much broader set of indicators we're looking at to determine how you should be moving forward, and you're now networked to 7 other districts that have a bunch of schools that we can network you to who may be doing better than you are on certain metrics. So this is about putting teacher to teacher, school to school, principal to principal together in a networked learning kind of way so that we can learn best practices from one another. It is a much preferable way to do business instead of being under the gun of shame and blame and you know, just simply yelling at people from the federal level telling us we're not doing it better or fast enough is simply not helpful. Us creating a system where we get to work with our colleagues across the state who can teach us better ways to do it is absolutely the only way to go. We fully believe that a networked world in education and a network across these districts is going to be the model that you see not only across California, but more and more as 46, 47 states are in the world of Common Core state standards. That's the way education is going to be working in the near future.
One last question before we go. As with most things in education, this decision is not without controversy. The California Teachers Association called this waiver counterproductive and divisive, and several prominent lawmakers and others in education announced that they're opposed to this waiver. They say all districts should follow the same rules. How do you respond to that, and how will this waiver change the way that teachers are evaluated in your district?
So first I'll take teacher evaluation. We all have signed on, and we are at the bargaining table with our teachers union right now, and I spoke with our FTA president every week yesterday morning. I thought we had a great conversation, and we know that we have work to do together. We have made great strides, I think, together in understanding where we are locally. And it will work out in each district in a little different way because we all have different needs. I'm very confident that we're going to be able to cross the bridge productively here in Fresno. It's not going to be dramatically different. But I do think taxpayers, parents, and everyone else have a reasonable expectation that if students go into a classroom, that after the course of a year, there should be some growth as by virtue of being in a classroom for a year, and that's fair game to be able to talk about. And so that's the kind of conversation that we're in. This is, I think people make more about the high-stakes nature of it than they really should, number one. Number two, I would say to all the critics, please, before you become too dug in with all of your high and mighty criticisms, please read the entire waiver. Read the waiver again, and then call somebody who's involved in one of the districts who is doing this difficult work and have a conversation. The California Teachers Association and President Dean Vogel, I know Dean. I like Dean. I respect Dean. I just vehemently disagree with his point of view on this. We need to move forward, and I don't think everybody needs to be working in exactly lockstep version. That's a CTA model of the way they run their organization throughout the state, but that's actually not the way that we like to run school districts, and that the governor has actually aligned with his local control funding formula where he puts the local control in the hands of local boards in local communities to make their best decisions. So we have been trying to work with our unions at the state level. We will certainly do it here in Fresno, and we will continue to reach out as we go forward.
We've been talking with Fresno Unified Superintendent Michael Hansen about the Obama administration's decision last week to grant the district an exemption from the No Child Left Behind Act. This is Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio. Most California residents are probably familiar with abalone. The sea snail's native habitat is along the California coast. For decades, abalone fishermen have flocked to the shore to catch them. One abalone species has suffered the consequences of its tasty meat more than most. The white abalone is endangered almost to the point of extinction. But as Amy Quinton reports from Sacramento, UC Davis scientists think they've set the mood for its recovery.
In the UC Davis Bodega Marine Laboratory, Kristen Aquilino reaches into a fish tank.
All right, I'm going to pull up this pipe here, show you some of these juveniles.
Aquilino heads the white abalone captive breeding program. She often talks like a proud mother when she points to the tiny creatures.
Aww, right? These turned one on June 14th of this year, so they're just over a year old.
Cute, but they are sea snails, so why exactly should anyone care?
So right now, the population is in really, really bad shape. There are only a few thousand left in the wild. The animals that are left in the wild are so far apart from one another that they likely are effectively sterile. And so effectively, this population might already be extinct in the sense that it's not currently reproducing on its own.
Because white abalone are broadcast spawners, males and females have to be in close proximity for a sperm to find an egg. Melissa Newman with the National Marine Fisheries Service says scientists had it all wrong about the animal.
We used to think of abalone as being this this animal that you could never, never deplete.
They thought abalone acted like other shelled organisms, living relatively short lives and reproducing often.
That's why fishing for them went on for as long as it did, without us pulling the plug on it.
But Newman says white abalone are delicate little creatures.
Abalone sort of behave more like a mammal in that they live to be 30. They're not reproductive until they're probably more like, 5 to 8 years old. And they're only producing offspring maybe once a decade successfully.
So researchers had a big job, get the animals to breed in captivity, something that hadn't happened in nearly a decade. To do so, Kristen Aquilino has to get up close and personal with them.
We can tell the sex by looking at their gonad. Let's see if this one wants to show it at us, its gonad. It's maybe not appropriate for radio.
Yeah, we'll leave that to the imagination. Aquilino points to dark tanks that house two white abalone. She says this is where the mood is set.
We've definitely got our thing together, don't we?
So we have lighting. Lights come on and off the same time the sun rises and sets in the abalone's native range in Southern California. And we have the temperature manipulated. We feed them lots of algae. We sometimes play some Barry White.
Okay, so Aquilino says the Barry White music is not scientific, but after much trial and error came success.
In our care was a very small but important ray of hope for this entire species.
It's still a long road ahead. Abalone females can produce millions of eggs, but only 1% survive to become juveniles. And in captivity, getting white abalone to become reproductive every year is more difficult than with their more abundant cousin, the red abalone. Aquilino says their research began using what they learned from red abalone farms in California.
So we start with using their best techniques and then fiddling with them to try to make it right for the white abalone. It's definitely possible that a lot of the work we're doing here could be applicable to red abalone farms and could help them increase production or reduce costs.
Ultimately, the goal is to one day repopulate the oceans with white abalone. Scientists say it will take several decades, if not longer, but at least they'll have Barry White to listen to. In Sacramento, I'm Amy Quinton.
Can't you see it, you?
You can find out more about the white abalone and see pictures on our website, kvpr.org. And stay with us. We'll be back with more of our program in just a moment. We'll talk with author Linda Marsa about her new book, Fevered, and find out what climate change could mean for our health here in the Central Valley. That's coming up next on Valley Edition.
Local funding for FM89 comes from FM89 Broadcaster Circle, providing major gifts in support of FM89's mission.
This is Valley Edition. Rising global temperatures aren't just an international concern, they're also an important local issue, especially when it comes to public health. How will climate change affect everything from rates of asthma and valley fever to wildfires and natural disasters? Those are just some of the questions asked in a new book called Fevered, Why a Hotter Planet Will Hurt Our Health and How We Can Save Ourselves. The book's author, award-winning health and science journalist Linda Marsa, joins us now. Linda, welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me, Joe.
You've been covering this issue for a while now. How did you come to write this particular book about these more localized effects of this global phenomena that we're so concerned about?
Well, obviously, as a science journalist, I was very aware of the problems with climate change, but a lot has been written about it, to be honest. And I thought, how can I write about this in a fresh, interesting way? And I guess about 4 years ago when I got started writing the book, there was this report in The Lancet, which is a very esteemed British science journal, about how the public health aspect of climate change has not been dealt with at all, and it's really actually the number one public health issue that we're going to be confronting in the 21st century. And then after that, what I really wanted to sort of personalize is, you know, how this is affecting us in this country right here and right now. And so I sort of drilled down, and one of the places that climate change is really affecting is the California Central Valley in a lot of ways.
Can you elaborate on that? And
sure.
In what ways do you see?
Well, the two things that I found that I thought were really sort of very interesting about the Central Valley is, first, the bad air. and then also Valley Fever, which is an illness that's been sort of endemic in the Central Valley and got its name from the Central Valley. It's been around for, I don't know, hundreds of years, actually. There's been reports of it. But it's really starting to maybe a silent epidemic. The Centers for Disease Control calls it a silent epidemic, which one of the drivers really is this hotter, drier climate that we're getting in terms of climate change.
Can you elaborate a little more on that? Because these are conditions and things that are not new. We've had them for a long time, as you mentioned. What are scientists telling you?
There's several drivers, you know, so you don't want to just sort of blame climate change completely. And a lot of people are sort of looking at this. A lot of scientists are looking at it to see. But Valley Fever is caused by a fungus. And the fungus is carried in spores that, you know, live in the soil. And, you know, when you have excavation and sort of a movement of the soil, you're going to have the fungal spores, you know, sort of aerosolize. So, you know, we're seeing a lot of, you know, this type of valley fever where you have a lot of construction. And another big piece of it is these new weather patterns that are fueled by global warming. So you have a rising temperature, then you have droughts followed by drenching rains and parched landscapes, so that you have these more violent winds that kick up the dust clouds that travel for hundreds of miles. You know, and they've sort of created this perfect storm for the transmission of valley fever. These kochia spores burrow several layers beneath the soil surface, and then they benefit from higher temperatures because that encourages the fungal growth. And then what's more, during these scorching summer months, the intense heat kills off the surface vegetation, so when the rain does fall, the fungus flourishes without any competition. And because the hotter temperatures burn off the desert grasses, roots, and plants that anchor the soil, more dust can be roiled by the churning winds, which often carry the spores for, you know, 500 miles or more. And many scientists believe that as the environmental belt that's hospitable to the fungus widens with longer, hotter, and drier summers, the number of people stricken could, you know, greatly multiply.
You spent some time in Central California researching this book, and I want to talk about some of these issues. And one of the things that you talk about in the book is this issue of CO2 domes. And this is a phenomena scientists have found in urban areas where CO2 levels can be up to twice as much as the global average. And you say that these CO2 domes actually act as something like pressure cookers for temperatures and things in these urban areas and exacerbate a lot of other problems, correct?
Absolutely. Well, you know, breathing in all that carbon dioxide and all those pollutants, we know that's not good. And we know that, you know, it causes asthma and all kinds of respiratory ills. But, you know, as we're, you know, dumping more and more of this carbon dioxide into the atmosphere, it is starting to form what's called these CO2 domes over cities, which are, you know, these sort of toxic clouds of pollutants. They're having this in Salt Lake City, which has actually, you know, sort of similar typography to the Central Valley. You know, the Salt Lake City is in a valley, too. So you're getting all that trapping of those stagnant air masses. And it was a Stanford University study, you know, that found, as you said, that these domes act like pressure cookers, and they exacerbate pollution's harmful health effects. And some of the harmful health effects, as I mentioned, is increasing asthma, you know, increasing allergies, and also they've linked pollution to heart disease because it causes plaque to form on the wall of arteries, and it thickens the walls of arteries, and even in some cases dementia. There was one study that linked pollution, you know, high levels of pollution to dementia. So this is the kind of stuff that we're seeing, and this Stanford University study said that these CO2 domes may already be responsible for up to 1,000 excess deaths every year across the country. And, you know, in the Central Valley is sort of a microcosm of all of that because, it has, you know, really, really terrible air.
You spoke with a physician at UCSF Fresno, Dr. Jose Joseph, a physician there, and he said that we're just seeing the tip of the iceberg, essentially, in the public health impacts from not only air pollution, but the climate change that is the result of the CO2 that we're expelling into the atmosphere. Elaborate a little more on what he told you in your conversation.
Well, he was really quite wonderful. I really greatly enjoyed talking to him. But he really talked about this. I mean, he's a pulmonologist. He's seen, you know, he treats all these people who are sick. He's seen, you know, the rising rates of asthma. He's seen the rising rates of, you know, allergies. And, you know, there's a lot of premature deaths. You know, they're predicting that in, you know, 10 or 20 years, one out of every four children in the Central Valley is going to have asthma. That's staggering. I interviewed, you know, people at the Clinica Sierra, you know, who are really, you know, very dedicated people down there. And, you know, this one fellow was telling me that he's got, in every room, he's got kids on nebulizers and steroids. And he said, 10 years ago, I didn't see this. He said, it's really frightening. Because, you know, you really don't want to put young kids on this very heavy artillery. And the problem is that, you know, the lung development of children who live in these highly polluted areas, they've done studies on this, their lung development is stunted. It's about 20% smaller than average, which greatly impairs their lung function. They suffer from asthma at significantly high rates, and the problem is that this impairment follows them throughout life. So as adults, they're much more prone to have respiratory diseases and, you know, have chronic obstructive pulmonary disease and things like that. So these are the kinds of things that I was talking about with him.
There's also natural disasters and wildfires that are big concerns in regards to climate change and how rising global temperatures will affect both of those issues. As of last Friday in the West, there were 36 large active wildfires in 9 Western states. 9 of those 36 are in California, including one in Fresno County. Tell me a little more about what you learned as far as how climate change has the folks who battle wildfires concerned.
You know, this is sort of common sense. The hotter it is, the more it dries. And the more it dries, the more you have more kindling. So that's sort of one aspect of it. And by 2050, the USDA Fire Service expects that a changing climate could increase wildfires by 50% across the U.S. and over 100% in areas of the West. You know, we have the years of drought, and the open spaces make this region especially prone. All right, and fire seasons are now more destructive in the past, and each year surpasses the previous one for record-setting fires, just because it's hotter. The other piece of this, which I find extraordinarily insidious, is, again, we've talked about how climate change changes ecosystems, too. So what we have now is that we have hundreds of millions of pine trees on millions of acres across the West have been denuded by bark or white pine beetles. And the insects bore through the protective bark on trees, and they infect them with this fatal fungus that kills the trees. So once the trees die, you left behind these brittle husks that provide kindling for these blazes. And increasing temperatures are largely responsible for the widespread infestation. In fact, you know, what one scientist at the National Center for Atmospheric Research told me is that, you know, in Canada, there are now fears that these bark beetles could wipe out the whole boreal forest, which is really very frightening.
And that would also, by wiping out a large forest that essentially takes in CO2, that only reinforces the problem, does it not?
Right. Well, it creates, there's two things that wildfires do to create feedback loops. That's one. That's one aspect. And the other one is, duh, you know, some of this stuff is like, you know, when you read it, you think, well, of course. Wildfires pump enormous amount of CO2 in the atmosphere, you know, about 290 million metric tons annually, which is equal to 4 to 6% of the nation's CO2 emissions from just burning fossil fuels. So these large infernos spew these massive pulses of greenhouse gases into the atmosphere, you know, so that severe fire seasons are creating just as much greenhouse gas as vehicle emissions. So that again, you're creating more of these feedback loops.
If you just joined us on Valley Edition, we're talking with Linda Marsa. She's the author of a new book called Fevered, Why a Hotter Planet Will Hurt Our Health and How We Can Save Ourselves. She not only looks at the problems, but also potential solutions in this book. And I want to talk about some of those right now, Linda. It's easy to say the sky is falling. Woe is us. What are we going to do? There's lack of global consensus on climate change. what do you see as some steps that communities can take to try to address this or mitigate some of these concerns?
Well, I have to say, Joe, that when I first started writing the book, I was in utter despair. You know, I'm talking to all these scientists, and, you know, they're telling me the sky's falling and we're careening over the abyss and no one's paying any attention. And then I started drilling down and talking to people in local governments and community groups and things like that, and people take climate change very seriously. There's not any debate. They're, you know, taking steps to prepare their communities for climate change and trying to smooth the path toward a cleaner, greener, healthier future. You know, we worry about water here in the West. There are two places here in the West that are leading the world in water management. Las Vegas, which is one of the driest cities and probably one of the driest states in the Union. There's a woman there, Pat Mulroy, who is the water manager in Las Vegas. She's well known. She's sort of a hero in water management circles because she's made Las Vegas, which is a very dry city, extremely self-sufficient. And she started in a very stepwise process because she said you can't make a population of 2 million people turn on a dime. First thing she did is she went to all the owners, you know, people like Steve Wynn, who owned all the big hotels, and she got them to recycle all the water from their fountains, from their golf courses, from all the places like this. And she not only got them to recycle, she got them to pay for it. That was the first thing. And then the second thing she did is she instituted this Cash for Grass program. And what she did is she paid people to pull up their lawns. She paid them so much square footage. And as a friend of mine, a reporter friend of mine, said if it was up to Pat Mulroy, she'd rip out every blade of grass in Las Vegas County. Now, in Orange County, California, what they've done is they've instituted a toilet-to-tap groundwater reclamation program where they take toilet water and they purify it and make it, you know, drinking water. And 20% of the drinking water in Orange County, California comes from this recycled sewage water, which if you go on my website, there's a picture of me in a hard hat happily drinking the water, which tasted just fine. But the point here is what they did, it's not just the technology to do it, but what they did is they did a community outreach program. They showed people that the water is safe to drink, and they brought everybody on board. And the program that they've implemented has become a template for cities around the world. The one point that I keep bringing out is that a lot of these programs are beyond the pilot program phase. They have proved that they work. There's a lot of programs across the country that can be adopted in other places and on a national basis that are, to use the cliche, shovel-ready. So I was very gratified to see that.
We've been talking with Linda Marsa. Her new book is called Fevered, Why a Hotter Planet Will Hurt Our Health and How We Can Save Ourselves. It's out in stores now and on Amazon.com. Linda, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Joe Moore. Over the past several weeks, we've watched as Edward Snowden, the NSA analyst accused of releasing classified government information, escaped to Russia in an attempt to find asylum. Now that his immediate future has been settled, Fresno State professor Dr. Jack Benega explores the moral implications of his actions in this segment of FM89's commentary series, The Moral Is.
We Americans can't seem to make up our minds about Edward Snowden. A Huffington Post poll in July 2013 found that nearly 40% of Americans thought Snowden did the wrong thing, with another 30% remaining unsure. A week later, a Quinnipiac University poll found the opposite, that by a 55 to 34% margin, respondents judged Snowden to be a whistleblower and not a traitor. In our system, whistleblowers often receive protection. Traitors are punished. Was Edward Snowden acting morally? An attorney working the case claimed Snowden only sought to expose a surveillance state and our government's violation of Fourth Amendment rights. He said his client was offended at the information he was asked to collect by the NSA. To make sense of this case, consider another earlier whistleblower, or traitor, the ancient Greek philosopher Socrates. His peers also had trouble deciding. As you may remember, Socrates was tried by a jury with disrespecting the gods and with corrupting the youth. Like with Edward Snowden, the opinions of Socrates' guilt were split, but eventually he was sentenced to death. Just before he was to be executed, however, a chance emerged for Socrates to escape. Unlike Snowden, who made sure to escape before his information was released, Socrates turned down the opportunity, telling his friend Crito, "This is my country. I was born and educated here. Athens gave me liberty and choice. If at any time I didn't like what Athens offered me, I could, without any penalty, have gone elsewhere. But because I chose to remain in Athens, I entered into an implied contract promising to obey its laws unless I could persuade it that its laws were unjust. If I stayed here when times were to my liking and then escaped only after being imprisoned, who am I if not a corrupter of the laws?" So, how are we to judge these actions? A young Edward Snowden, sensing an injustice, escapes to safety before he can be caught and tried. And an elderly Socrates, unjustly accused of wrongs, stays to face his accusers. My colleague, Fresno State philosophy professor Dr. Andrew Fiala, has proposed a ranking of responses of how morally to respond in the face of injustice. At the lowest level, the responder complies or obeys. He does nothing to confront the injustice. Neither Snowden nor Socrates took this path. At a much higher level, the responder conscientiously objects or engages in civil disobedience. This was the route chosen by Socrates. But one type of response remains in Fiala's ranking, the unjust response, feigning compliance while duplicitously acting in defiance of official obligations. This is what Snowden did. Whistleblower or traitor? Moral action or not? You decide. For The Moral Is, this is Jacques Benninga.
You're listening to Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio. Stay with us. We'll be back in just a moment to close out this week's program, as we'll hear an interview with Kerman farmer Paul Betancourt. He's the author of a new book called 10 Reasons, Finding Balance on Environmental Issues. That's coming up in just a moment here on Valley Public Radio.
I'm Ezra Romero with these news headlines. California Governor Jerry Brown has signed a bill that increases the rights of transgender students at public schools. It will allow students to participate in extracurricular activities and use school facilities based on their gender identity, not their physical characteristics. Critics have suggested bad actors could use the law to prey on school children, but the bill's author, Democratic Assemblymember Tom Omeano, calls the complaint scare tactics and says it'll go away with education.
And also proof in the pudding, like L.A. and San Francisco and Arcadia and Willits, where nothing bad happens. And obviously, if there was any misbehavior, just like for any student, there would be methods to deal with it.
The LGBT community and civil rights groups are praising the governor's signature. Several Republican lawmakers have tweeted their frustration, including Assemblymember Melissa Melendez, who wrote, "Say goodbye to your daughter's innocence and privacy." A legal group says it's seeking plaintiffs to challenge the new law in court. The measure takes effect January 1st. For Valley Public Radio, I'm Ezra Romero.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Joe Moore. How can we balance environmental issues and the economy? Agriculture and water? Those are just some of the questions asked in a new book by Kerman farmer Paul Betancourt. It's called 10 Reasons, Finding Balance on Environmental Issues. Paul joins us today. Welcome.
Good morning.
What prompted you to write this book?
Well, for years I've been farming for 30 years, heavily involved with Farm Bureau for 20 years. You know, I can do everything right on the farm and still get clobbered with regulations and water issues and things that are off the farm. And have lobbied in Washington and Sacramento. I spent 3 years on the Regional Water Quality Control Board as an appointee of Governor Schwarzenegger. And it just been heavily involved in the issue. And One of the unique things is not growing up on the farm is I have the perspective, you know, growing up in the city in Southern California and seeing how people look at the environment and also seeing how my neighbors see the environment and trying to find a balance there instead of the either or we tend to end up with in environmental issues.
Do you think that's a problem in the fact that the way the media or just the public in general sticks people in different camps or saying it's always farmers versus environmentalists and farmers are against the environment and environmentalists are against farmers, or those stereotypes that maybe are in reality a little more nuanced?
Well, I think that's true. But it's also, you know, one of the virtues of modern life is people don't have to go through farming themselves. But one of the downsides of that is most consumers are very distant from their food supply. And even here in the Valley, there's a lot of people that don't even know a farmer. And that distance between the farm and the home, there's the ability to create fear and misunderstanding. And you know, one of my goals being involved in Farm Bureau writing is to kind of reconnect people with their food.
Jim Costa wrote the foreword to this book. Mm-hmm. In some circles in the agriculture community, he's a pariah. You drive around and see the cotton trailers with the various signs. He doesn't seem to be too popular with a certain segment of the agriculture community. Talk about having him write the foreword.
Yeah, I've even had people suggest I take that out, and I'm not going to do it. You know, Jim's been a water warrior over the years. He's done a lot for the Valley on water issues. And you know, in the foreword there, he mentions, you know, being in the Oval Office, explaining to President Obama that farmers are price takers, not price makers, and that each time they pile a regulation on, you know, the farmers just got to take it. And you know, the president had not heard that message, and we need somebody like Congressman Costa in there, you know, going to bat for us.
You had political ambitions at one point. You ran for state assembly, what was it, about 8 years ago?
10 years ago.
10 years ago. Why? Time flies.
We must have been having fun.
Is that still something that you think about at some point in the future? Or is I mean, sometimes people write books before they run for office.
Yeah. I consider myself a recovering politician. I haven't asked anybody for money lately. But still very involved. I teach Constitution at University of Phoenix. I teach an American government class at Madera Center Community College. We have an amazing system that invites our participation even if we're not elected officials. And I think it's important that people participate in government.
You talk about these 10 reasons. We don't have time to go into all of them, but I'd like to talk about a few of them. Solutions. You look to the future and what can we do to try to make the future a little stronger for both the farmer and for the public and the environment as well.
Well, one of my issues is I'm critical of the environmental movement for not offering solutions, the opening paragraph. I'll start believing environmentalists when they start offering solutions. What I usually see is a presentation of a problem. They jump up and down and tell us to stop. You know, for example, they'll tell us how bad overpopulation is, then tell us to stop it. What kind of solution is that? It would be nice if their solutions made sense. You know, one suggestion they had was dust on dirt roads in our area was to water the dirt roads every day. Do you know how many miles of dirt roads there are in Fresno County? Do you know how much water that would take? Do you know how many of those roads have no traffic at all during the day? That wasn't much of a solution. And it's one of my criticisms of the environmental movement. They need to offer reasonable solutions. I actually had a professor at Fresno State. He says, that's not our job. He considered himself a radical environmentalist, and he'd bring up problems. He says, that's not our job to offer solutions. The business community is innovative. They'll figure it out. And you know, I teach critical thinking, and that's not a very good problem-solving method.
Speaking of solutions, let's take a look at some of the issues right now. And the big one that's out there is the Bay Delta Conservation Plan and this plan for two massive tunnels, a multi-billion-dollar project that the governor and folks in Sacramento are looking at implementing to help bring water supplies from the Sacramento-San Joaquin Delta through that environmentally sensitive area to Southern California and the Valley. One of the biggest challenges beyond the technical side, beyond the cost side, this is not just an issue that pits environmentalists versus farmers. This is an issue that pits farmers versus farmers. North of the Delta, south of the Delta, it's a classic California water war and the environmental issue that's thrown into the mix. What type of solution do you think is realistic here, cost-effective, and can help both those who provide jobs, make a living growing food, and also protect a sensitive ecosystem?
There is no doubt there are biological problems in the Delta. It's pelagic organism decline. But there's also, I raise the question, are we trying to defend an artificial system? The deltas have been an artificial system for over a century once they started building up the islands. But, you know, that just kind of begs the question. And your question is, how do we do it and how do we do it affordably? Farmers don't agree. We're not very well organized. You get five of us together and there'll be 10 different opinions. And the Northern California farmers are worried that their water supply is going to be hurt by putting in this conveyance system. That's something we need to consider. The real root of it is, you know, we're kind of idiots when it comes to water systems. California has wet years and California has dry years. And we don't capture the water in the wet years and save it for the dry years. And until we get that part of the equation taken care of, we're going to have problems. I've looked at the water records back at least to the 1860s, and in every 20-year period, there's a three-year drought. We've just got to plan for it, and we haven't gotten there yet.
It seems like we may be in one of those periods right now. What's it like on the farm right now?
The droughts are usually 2 and 3 years. We've had two dry. I'm hoping this one's a two-year, and it starts raining this winter, because if it doesn't rain this winter, it's going to get very lonely out on the farm next summer.
How are your water allocations this year, and what are you looking at for next year?
We're at 20%, we finished paying off the ranch a few years ago, and I immediately turned around, borrowed $200,000 to stick a hole in the ground. At least I've got water. The quality's not very good. It's really only an emergency system, but it gets me through years like this when I've only got a 20% allotment.
What does that mean when you have a 20% allotment versus a – I know what that means in terms of the water you have contracted to buy, but what does it mean in real terms as far as, okay, I only have 20% of the water I would normally have. I'm going to farm differently. I'm going to plant different crops. I'm going to fallow a certain field.
Well, at 20-25% with the well, I can farm my entire place. But there's a lot of open ground on the west side, and there's guys on the west side now saying – if water's tight next year, they're not going to plant any row crops, no cotton, no tomatoes, no onions, and they're going to put all their water into keeping their almond trees alive. So if water's tight again next summer, there's going to be a huge shift in production, and a lot of row crops will be cut back.
We're talking with Kerman farmer Paul Betancourt. He's the author of a new book called 10 Reasons, Finding Balance on Environmental Issues. It's an interesting look at the complex relationships in California between agriculture and the environment, looking to another issue that is certainly controversial when it comes to agriculture here in the Valley, and that's high-speed rail. Many farmers are very concerned about what this means for their future to viably farm their land. It'll have the rails, because this is high speed, this can't turn on a dime. It has to take these broad swaths of arcs of railway, and that's going to divide many parcels in odd ways. The Rail Authority has talked about trying to mitigate that. But this isn't the first time that a major infrastructure project has cut through valley farmland. We've seen it with freeways. We've seen it with the projects of the State Water Project. Are we at a point right now in the progress of high-speed rail where the agriculture community is coming to terms with it? I know there's still lawsuits. I know that's still a very hot issue. But what do you feel the temperature of the agriculture community is right now in regards to high-speed rail?
Great question. Their folks are still grumpy about it. There's no two ways about it. And let's be clear, I use the train. We stopped going to visit my family. They live in Southern California. We stopped going by driving ourselves 10 years ago. And we take the train, and I'd much rather it be a 2 or 3 hour trip than an 8 hour trip. But really, for me, the root problem is we fight and scrap and beg and use political capital to get a $3 billion water project. It gets larded into an $11 billion water bond. And last year, the same week that they punt the water bond, they sign up for a $68 billion high-speed rail issue. That water bond will help everybody in California, and it's a fraction of the cost. High-speed rail is part of our future, but it'll only help a small portion of the people right now. And I think we got our priorities mixed up as a state. We need to get these water projects in, get a reliable water supply. That will develop not only the agricultural economy, but the rest of the economy of the Central Valley. Then we can look at things like high-speed rail.
You close your book with a section called Finding Balance, and mm-hmm. I go back to the cover of the book, actually, and you have, I assume this is your footwear, on the left side of the photo you see Birkenstocks, and on the right, some cowboy boots, well-worn. Number one, I assume those are yours?
Yes.
How do you, number one, see yourself in that picture of finding balance, and then how do you think we can best find balance in the state and have a strong, healthy environment and also a strong and healthy ag economy?
A friend of mine says I'm the only person she knows that can wear Birkenstocks and cowboy boots. So that's how that ended up on the cover. Because of my life experience, I can straddle both sides of the fence better than many people can. So that's how the cover ended up there. In terms of summary finding balance, it's first off, either or is usual a logical fallacy. And people will tell you we either, run the economy and screw the environment, or we, protect the environment and let businessmen settle where they want. That's not it. We need a healthy economy and a healthy environment. And we have to find solutions that develop that. There's no turning back. We like modern life. And there's an environmental cost to modern life, so we need to figure out solutions without trying to go back to the Stone Age. One of the things I bring up in that last chapter is essentially we've got a social contract. There's a demand on farmers to accept the cost of growing in more environmentally sound ways, careful with the water, careful with the pesticides, better wages for the workers. And there's an implied social contract there. We'll do that. But then we're asking you to buy food from us instead of buying it from somebody else because it's cheaper. And it's an implied social contract, and it gets broken a lot of times. My last year as Farm Bureau president, I was shocked by the number of politicians, journalists, academics, and regulators that said, well, if you can't comply, we'll just buy or import our food. And that's a ridiculous solution. We need to make this work in California. So those are the kind of things when I'm looking at solutions. I take at the end of the book and take Albert Schweitzer's Reverence for Life and apply that. Let's make that our environmental ethic. Let's respect and value life and learn how to balance a healthy environment and a healthy economy.
We've been talking with Kerman farmer Paul Betancourt. His new book is titled 10 Reasons Finding Balance on Environmental Issues. Paul, it's available in bookstores both online and also locally?
Yep. It's here at the local Barnes & Nobles. We're trying to get it in a couple other stores. It's available from Zulon Press, who published it, also Amazon.com and BarnesandNobles.com.
And the book is also available at a book barn in Old Town Clovis. He'll be having a signing there September 14th. Paul, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for the opportunity.
That's all for this Valley Edition. You can hear audio archives and subscribe to our podcast online at kvpr.org. We welcome your comments and suggestions. You can email us, talk@kvpr.org. Also, follow us on Twitter, @kvpr. For audio engineer Marv Allen, production and operations manager Don Weaver, Valley Edition producer Ezra Romero, and reporter Rebecca Plevin, I'm Joe Moore. This is Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation and the California Healthcare Foundation, supporting ideas and innovations to improve healthcare for all Californians. On the web at chcf.org.